Hey everyone, just wanted to let you all know that we're taking next week off. We only take 2 weeks off a year this week and then also a week at Christmas. So hopefully this gives you a chance to catch up on some episodes that you may have missed and to come up with some great questions for our next batch of recordings. So let me tell you about some of the episodes we're working on. One on the joys and importance of quitting. This is especially important for people who have internalized that they should never quit. So please give us your questions, your curiosities, everything quitting related. Another one on AI and creativity, like how does using AI interfere with creativity? How has it boosted creativity? If you found that to be the case, we can take this one in any direction. We are also talking with someone who has done a ton of research, has a new book coming out about basically how inconceivable it is to have a family. So this is both the difficulties in getting pregnant, the difficulties in having enough money to be secure enough to start a family. So whatever questions you have about your own life, what you're seeing around you, this one's going to go in so many different directions. And then another one about the women's fitness industrial complex. I am so excited to talk about various trends that we're seeing. We can talk about protein and weightlifting. We can talk about pinkwashing. We can talk about like protein again, all sorts of supplements. So that one's going to be fun. You can submit your questions at tinyurl.com/culturestudypod. And that's also where you can send in your questions for Ask Anna Anything. We always need more of those. And please also suggest topics for new episodes. Thank you so much. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. This is the Culture Study Podcast, and I'm Anne Helen Peterson.
I'm Tracy Clark Flory. I'm a journalist, essayist, and the author of the memoir, My Mother's Daughter, Finding Myself in My Family's Fractured Past.
Okay, we're going to start sentimental.
Okay.
I want to start by asking you about your favorite memory of your mom.
Oh, gosh, that's such a hard one.
Like, if you wanted, the way that Melody phrased this, I liked, which is like, when you think of your mom at her best, what do you think of?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, and I hate to say this because, well, you'll see why. It taps into so many gendered tropes. But I think my happiest memories are with my mom. The feelings that are just like suffused with such warmth are her cooking and her taking care of me when I was sick as a kid. So it's like, it's the washcloth held to the forehead.
Yeah.
You know, it's the bowl that I need to puke in that she's like, you know, bringing to me on the couch. It's like her in the kitchen grilling up a grilled cheese sandwich with some Kraft singles.
Yeah.
You know, like those are like those core memories of being cared for.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So all of this matters because we're talking about boomer moms today, but we're talking specifically at the beginning, at least, about your boomer mom. And we're going to use this as like your story as a way to kind of like work through some of these larger questions about our relationships with our boomer moms, some of our difficulties. But first, let's talk about your new memoir, My Mother's Daughter. It came out in May.
Yep.
What's it about? That's a huge question. I know. And like, there's a great Modern Love segment that we'll point people towards that like gives the recap. But for people here right now, what's the like elevator pitch for it?
Yeah, the elevator pitch is, so it's called My Mother's Daughter, Finding Myself in My Family's Fractured Past. And it's a memoir about how a DNA test connected me with my sister, Kathy. I knew that my mom had gotten pregnant as a teenager in the Midwest in the 60s, 20 years before I was born. I also knew that she had been sent away to a home for unwed mothers, that she had the baby, a girl, and placed her for adoption. And I also knew that she was then committed to a mental institution in her grief over losing her baby. That is all I knew, just those broad strokes of a story. And My mom had died years earlier. So in finding my sister, Kathy, we had all these big questions about what had happened back in 1965. So like a good journalist, I dove in and did my research. And I learned that my mom was one of an estimated 1.5 million women who were sent away to homes for unwed mothers in the pre-Roe era.
Startling.
And it's like 3 million who are estimated to have placed babies for adoption between 1950 and 1975.
Yeah.
Like thousands of parents were sending their young pregnant girls away every year in that era.
Yeah.
And so I learned she was pulled into this coercive system that was designed to turn, quote unquote, bad girls into proper women and wives and mothers. It was meant to control women's sexuality, promote marriage, bolster the white nuclear family norm. And in this research, I came to understand that my own life had been profoundly shaped by my mother's past. But I also uncovered a bigger story about shame and family secrets and race, the control of women's bodies, and also probably most relevant to what we're talking about here today, everything that we inherit from our mothers in a world that hates them.
Right.
Which is a lot.
one of the questions that we actually didn't use because it actually got so like straight to the heart of the issue is it was like, why do so many boomers moms like hate other women? And it's just like, it's this internalized misogyny that is really, really, really difficult to grapple with. And our goal with this episode is to complicate the way that we think about boomer moms. It is not to like rag on boomer moms. We have a lot of boomer moms in the audience, and obviously we are not boomer moms, so we are talking from the perspective of boomer daughters, so we're going to be doing our best to like talk about what we understand, but would also love, of course, any boomer moms who are listening to come and offer further context and experience in the comments. But I think like there's this quote that I get that from the very beginning of your book that I keep coming back to. And you're talking about like looking at the home for unwed mothers. Like you go and visit it and you like are looking at it outside and you're like, this building is part of my origin story. And you say, I understand that now. I spent so much of my life facing off with shame as a young woman grasping for sexual empowerment and as a journalist exploring taboo subcultures. I wanted to believe that I was free of that wagging finger, but I inherited my mom's shame along with the world that shamed her.
You know, I just thought I would open the book up with a very light moment.
Or there's another moment where you're talking about like just thinking back on how your mom like grappled with the daughter that she had was forced to give away for adoption and like all of these years of not knowing what happened to her and trying to like really reconcile herself to that fact. And you say like kind of offhandedly, you're like, how did it not eat away at her? And then you realize like, oh, it fucking did. Like
it did.
Every day.
That it was always there in the room with us, right? I mean, that was the thing is like, I definitely had a moment in my life where she finally told me about my sister and about being sent away. And so much of what I'd observed in my mom started to make sense, but it was really just only the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. Like I had detected as a little kid this secret at the heart of our family. You know, I had some sort of sense even of a sister, it seems.
Yeah.
Like I would lay in bed at night as a little kid and concoct stories about the secret sister that my parents were keeping down the hall from me. And I would hold my breath in hopes of being able to hear her breathing. So there's this way in which like my mom's secret was sensed, was there, was always in the room with us. And so to some degree, when she sat me down finally as a teenager and told me the very basic details of what had happened, it was like, oh, okay, some of this is starting to make sense. But it was really only once I found my sister, dove into the research, understood what these homes were, that I made these bigger ties to, like you mentioned, the fact that my mom was sent away in shame and I, in some ways, turned shame into my career by confronting it, investigating it continually as a journalist covering the sex beat.
Yeah. Yeah, which is like so fitting, but also like, you know, you're still doing the work. Like you still have to like confront that shame over and over and over.
Over and over and never fully escaping it either. I mean, that's the thing that's so interesting. I think it was both. Like it was, I was writing against what had been done to my mom. Like the earliest histories, one of the things that I was most fascinated by and just totally stunned me was that the earliest histories of these homes, they started as an attempt to quote unquote save sex workers before they redirected their attentions to unwed mothers.
Right.
And I'd spent so much of my career writing about sex worker rights, writing about the porn industry, like, you know, and it just was like, oh my God, like, I didn't even realize that like this thing has been driving me. And so I was writing against what had been done to her, her being sent away in shame, right?
Yeah.
But I was also stuck in it, you know? Yep. So it was both at once, like, you know, the fact of publishing very personal essays about sex on the internet and then being met with like messages from vile misogynistic internet trolls, you know, like this was this constant re-experiencing of shame. Yeah.
When was your mom born?
1946.
Okay. Yeah. So this is the other thing is I think some, like our moms are kind of on the opposite ends of boomerishness. My mom was born in 1956. She's about to turn 70. And then there are also boomers who are younger than that. Like one of my good friends, I think her experience is markedly different than my mom because she's another like 5, 6, 7 years younger.
Yeah.
Right. So like we're going all the way from your mom to my friend's experience in terms of like they're it's like millennials, right? Like an elder millennial has a very different experience than the youngest millennial. But I just keep thinking about, like, I was looking at, okay, birth control is introduced in 1960, and I think people often point to that date as like, oh, yeah, sexual revolution. It was not legal to have if you were an unmarried woman in, like, 23 states until 1972. Like,
It was taboo. I mean, it was like you had women putting on fake wedding rings to go to the doctor to try to get a prescription, right? It's not like it was suddenly just we're swimming in birth control pills.
I know. And I think sometimes we're like, oh, everything changed when our parents were growing up. Like, oh, like there was all of these different, like people believed in integration suddenly and everyone like understood that queer people were people. Like, no, right?
No.
Like a lot of these beliefs are hard won over the course of their adult lifehoods. Like,
totally. And I think about like specifically for my mom, who was sent away in 1965, like she was very much like just a little too early to kind of have been protected by some of the winds of the sexual revolution.
Totally.
And so it was right at this kind of turning point where she was still sent away in shame. She was a bad girl. She was all of those things. And it was as the sort of narratives about unwed mothers were starting to shift where it was like, it had been that they were kind of a, like a species of mental patient almost. And then it was like they're dangerous sexual revolutionaries.
Right.
And she was kind of caught up in the swirl of all of that pathologizing, you know?
Well, and also just like patriarchal control. And I don't just mean like the patriarchy. Like, I mean like their dads controlled what happened to them. Like my mom, this is a story I've heard my entire life. And like, I don't think it always sinks in the way that it should. My beloved granddad, who I loved so much, he told my mom, like, you cannot leave the state for college.
Yeah.
Like, she had a National Merit Scholarship. Yeah. She could have gone to so many different places. And he was like, no, you're not leaving the state.
Yeah.
Her older brother was allowed to leave the state, but not her. Right?
Yeah. Right. Well, and gosh, I mean, I've thought about this so much in the context of these homes, because in terms of like what felt possible for these women, and certainly when my mom presented this story to me initially, she said, my father sent me away.
Yes.
So, you know, there was a lot of clarity there. And I also do, you know, I do a lot of writing in this book around this generational inheritance, even just going back to my grandmother. Like my grandmother spent basically every day of her marriage hoping that her husband would die so that she would be free. And she was very explicit about that at the end of her life. When she was on her deathbed, she called the whole family into the room and said to him for all to hear, "I should have left you the day I married you. You promised me a second shot, a second chance at a happy life." And he literally had promised her that he would die first. "So just hang in there. I will die first and then you'll be set for life."
And like just holding on for that, right?
Holding on for that. And then for it to come out, you know, turn out to not be true.
Yeah.
And so I just, I'm thinking about that in the context of these, my mom always called that a deal with the devil. And it was like this story that she told me growing up. And it was a warning about how a woman could find herself trapped in marriage, right?
Yep.
But then my mom had her own deal with the devil in the sense that a lot of these adoptions in that era are like these histories about that era refer to them explicitly as such, that here, you can place your baby for adoption and then you can return
yep.
to a normative life. And especially since most of these women were white, it was a promise that you could return to white privilege, that you had fallen off your pedestal by getting pregnant. And now yeah. here, let us help return you to it. Granted, they were also left traumatized and grieving and struggling with mental health issues for the rest of their lives. So it was quite a lie what they were sold.
Right. We should also note here, and this is like very central to the book too, in part because your sister is Black. And mm-hmm. part of the reason that there was even more shame and taboo on your mom becoming pregnant when she did was because the father of the baby was Black.
Yes.
And I didn't realize, though, that they did not have similar institutions for Black women, because these institutions were understood as a way of like reinstating white privilege, like yeah. keeping the moral purity of these white women, whereas Black women were just supposed to just have the baby.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, it really is just like when you look at the way that unwed pregnancy, like the paths were determined along racial lines so clearly.
Yeah.
So Black women were expected to raise their own children, often within their extended families. And then they faced a host of associated consequences like lost education, poverty. They were targeted with harassment by welfare officials, sterilization. And then the visibility of Black single mothers was then used to make arguments around segregation in schools and stuff like yep. that. You know, it was yep, like yep. used to argue against the civil rights movement. You know, it's very clear, you very clearly see the conspiracy at play here.
Yeah. Yeah.
The way it played out. Yeah.
And if they did try to give their kids up for adoption, they could be like accused or persecuted for abandonment. Like,
yeah.
What a like systematic piece of fuckery going on there,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah. Yeah, it's real. Yeah, it's, I mean, that was the thing that really, that it totally overhauled my sense of my mom's story, because I had thought of her as having faced a difficult personal choice
yeah.
or predicament.
Yeah,
it was like she was a teenager. It was the Midwest. It was the 60s. She was unmarried. Then I, you know, came to see this larger system at play and saw that one, it wasn't a choice at all, that these adoptions were coerced and sometimes just outright forced. But two, that she was pulled into the gears of this racist and sexist machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Culture Study Podcast is sponsored by Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app. It helps you, you know, monitor your spending, like keep everything in one place. But the thing that I think is really valuable is it helps you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions and things that you have just kind of forgot about that maybe are an easy way to tighten your spending.
So I'm very devoted to my budget app, and I thought, Rocket Money's not going to have anything for me. And I was wrong. I got an email at the end of May that was like, here's a summary of your monthly spending. And I was like, I already know all of this. But then it told me how many times I had spent money at certain locations. And I never would have guessed that we spent money at Ace Hardware 21 times in the month of May. And it's because it is Polly's favorite place to go to on her walk. So we are always there. And then we're always like, well, I might as well grab something. So it made me think, how can we change our spending habits around Ace Hardware? Because I didn't realize we were going so much.
I think this is a really interesting philosophy about money, that it isn't always about like, how can I spend as little money as possible? It's more knowing where you're spending your money and also not accidentally having things like hanging on. Or like some stuff that I have on for the work that we do here. Like it catches when I still have my professional Zoom subscription and I don't need it anymore. Like I can cancel it for a few months, that sort of thing.
I also got an email letting me know that the price of one of my subscriptions had changed. So even though I had gone through the list and I was like, yes, I still want all of these subscriptions, when I got that email that was like, this is going up by $3 a month, then I was like,
So again, Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster, whatever they may be. Join at rocketmoney.com/culturestudy. That's rocketmoney.com/culturestudy. rocketmoney.com/culturestudy. Today's episode is sponsored by Honeylove. There's a lot of times in the summer where I find myself just continually wearing my sports bra because like I went on a run or something like that, and then I like just keep gardening afterwards. And the thing is like when you wear your like compressive sports bra all the time, it kind of like, I don't know, like my muscles get really sore. Like I'm like, oh, I've just been like tucked in too much all day. But I want something that's comfortable, that is still supportive, and that doesn't have an underwire. And you know what makes the perfect bra for that? Honeylove. Their crossover contour bra combines their like very famous wireless design, but then it has like some molded cups to create a little more of like a shape going on. Comfort is not a luxury, it's a requirement, and support shouldn't mean sacrificing how you feel in your own skin. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market and use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/culture. That's honeylove.com/culture. After you check out, they're going to ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. Okay, so we got so many questions.
I bet.
And I like this first one because, first of all, it like puzzle pieces well into the things that we've been talking about, but also for the way that this question asker, whose name is Emily, just opens up the question. It's just perfect. So let's hear from her.
My boomer mother is an extremely rich text, but the facet of her that I've never been able to make sense of is her and feminism. She faced severe sexism and discrimination in both her first career field as a musician and her second career field as a kitchen and bath designer running a remodeling company. She complained loudly about it for years. She eventually started her own successful company that lasted 25 years. And she still faced sexism from clients and contractors that whole time, to her great frustration. She's the reason that I became an outspoken feminist at 14. And yet she loathes feminism. Even now, when she and I have really thoughtful discussions about how frustrated she is with my dad's very sexist refusal to do most housework, she's so quick to disavow feminism as doing anything other than hating men, no matter what I say. I know that some of this is rooted in her conservative, now very MAGA, cult mindset. And it shows up in other places, like her deep love of solar and wind power, until Trump required them to hate it. But what else is going on? Does this have something to do with her growing up politically apathetic in Oakland in the 60s? It just feels like her values are diametrically opposed to her beliefs. I just cannot make sense of it.
Oh, I love Emily. I love, like, your mom is a rich text. All of our moms are rich texts. Yes. And that's like, I think sometimes it's useful to approach our loved ones' political beliefs from this, like, idea of, like, how do I analyze
Yeah.
Or break down, like, where they're all coming from. And obviously, we don't know, like, all of the details about Emily's mom. I'd love to know, yeah, like, exactly what year she was born and, like, more about right. her family in Oakland and, like, who did they vote for and right. that sort of thing. But what comes to mind here?
I mean, I'm immediately reminded of how my mom, who held a lot of very feminist beliefs, truly, would refer to herself as a humanist in a very pointed way,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she also introduced me pretty early on to the dissident feminist Camille Paglia.
Yeah.
who I'm embarrassed to admit I had a Camille Paglia phase. Like, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Many of us do.
A lot of people have a Camille Paglia phase.
But I did. And we bonded over it. And Camille would just, like, rail against, like, feminist victim mentality, yeah. right? And I very much see, like, my mom's positioning around all of that as arising from her being sent away and pulled into this system designed for oppression and, you know, a system that left so many women traumatized. And then emerging from that system, not with a sense of sort of like what it had done to her and so many other women, but more so with a sense of like personal responsibility.
Yes.
Taking personal responsibility for her choice, even though it was
yep.
coerced,
yep.
that she saw it as a source of her personal shame. And she never came to see the broader context of it. And also she sort of like, I think there was so much that she boxed up in order to survive that trauma. Mm-hmm. She boxed up her feelings about what had happened. She boxed up her feelings of loss over her first baby. And she became this very like tough, searingly smart kind of woman who would not take shit from any man. And I think implicit in that is that kind of like personal focus on personal responsibility, personal empowerment, personal savvy for kind of navigating yep. this dangerous world that we live in, right?
Yeah.
And that can feel empowering. It can feel empowering to feel like, well, it's in my hands.
Yes.
And I think it's scary oftentimes to admit, to look at this broader system because it can feel so disempowering.
Yes. I think one thing we have to remember is that feminism was like exoticized, like turned into bra burners, right? Like, do you remember this
yes.
from when you grew up in a different cultural context than I did in North Idaho in the 1990s?
Yep.
But
yep. Berkeley was quite different.
But like the images of like the bra burners were so yeah. salient to me, like as what feminism was like not shaving your armpits and like not wearing a bra, like such a very simplistic, like, and that was passed down to me, not just by the media, right? But like people who were older than me talking about what feminism was
yeah.
and also just an incredible feminist backlash through the 80s and 90s. Like, we did not say the word feminism. Like, it was an embarrassing thing to talk about out loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when I hear Emily talk about her mom, I'm like, oh, this is a girl boss, right? Mm. Like, there are a lot of things that are similar between, like, what yeah. Emily's mom is doing and, like, trying to navigate, like, this whole world. Like, she just wants to succeed on her own terms.
Yep.
And not have it be about her gender and like not interrogate these larger systems that
yeah.
or like leaning in. Like Emily's mom would love to lean in.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Exactly.
Like it's like, oh, I just need to behave like men instead yep. of I need to change the system to like not make it so everyone has to behave like men.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean to empathize with her mom. I really can, in the sense that, like, I think it's scary to face the lie of it all,
yeah.
right? Like, the lie that you can just lean in.
Yeah.
The lie that it's possible to, like, individually navigate out of patriarchy, especially when you're not even, like, able to say the word patriarchy to start, you know?
Yeah,
it's
just, yeah.
It's like...
yeah. You're just like, oh, these people don't respect me, but if I work harder, they should respect me.
I'll just keep trying.
It's very meritocracy, right? Like
100%. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why I'm thinking this just now, but it like makes me think about even just like how little kids will like personalize whatever dysfunction is happening in their family and then maybe like start acting out and then they get negative attention, and it, and they can say like, oh, well, I caused that. That there's this sense of like agency that's created, even, you know, like who knows her mom's like larger backstory, her childhood, all those things. Like, what is it that makes her feel like she needs to kind of like take this on as like, this is mine? I don't know. It feels like there's something deep there.
Yeah. And also just like the anger that somehow like, I see this sometimes too when people, including people of color, are very anti-affirmative action. Like, they don't want someone blaming a larger political movement for their success.
Yeah.
And I think that that is sometimes at the root of anti-feminism as well. It's like,
yeah,
feminism didn't do this for me. I did this for me.
Yeah. Well, and there's something too about like wanting to be the exceptional woman. Like,
again,
with the like internalized misogyny, like it's like you want to set yourself apart from all of that badness that we're told is women.
Yeah.
But not me.
And a lot of these women, and this is something that we have to remember, like a lot of these women were firsts, right?
Yeah,
or the
right.
onlys. And I think about this all the time when I think about like my family doctor, who was one of the first women, like not first, but one of the first class of medical students that also had a significant amount of women, and like then was the only woman in her, like the larger practice, one of just a handful of women. Or like some of my professors who were sometimes the first professors in their field, right? Or the only person in their grad program that was a woman. And what do you come up with? You come up with a protective armor that's like coldness, directness, all of these things. And sometimes you have a larger feminist politic that goes alongside that. And sometimes you're like, I'm just as good as men, and do not talk about my gender, and my gender doesn't matter.
Right. I am proof that you don't need feminism.
Yeah.
And and that women who are clinging to that have a victim mentality.
Yes. Okay. Next question. This is about boomer moms and their relationship with boomer dads. This is from Emma, and Melody's going to read it.
As I get older, I find that a lot of my frustrations with my own boomer mom stem from the lack of support she has received from my boomer dad. I don't want to let her off the hook for everything, but I can't help put most of the blame on the type of men available in the 80s and 90s when she got married. My dad wasn't abusive, absent, or controlling. He's just not a partner in the sense that we expect partners to act in 2026. Raising kids with an emotionally unavailable partner must have been incredibly hard, and without a true partner to turn to, it's no wonder she struggles with some of the stuff she deals with today. Besides encouraging therapy, I find I have little to say to her other than, I'm sorry you didn't have the help you needed. How can I encourage her personal growth without fully throwing my dad under the bus and criticizing their relationship?
So, Tracy, your dad seems pretty great, at least the way he comes off on the page.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's wonderful. I mean, I do, you know, if I'm totally honest, and I'll say this because I'm pretty sure he doesn't listen to your podcast. you know, like he was like a very present father. And that was like a really big part of like my narrative growing up, was like my mom was like so emphatic around the luck of me having a good dad, like a cuddly dad, a warm, present father, you know, like this was, you know, in many ways, I feel like she'd chosen him for me, you know, in this way, because it wasn't what she had from her father, who was like this 1950s, like, you know, tyrant who sent her away. And so there was definitely that feeling of like her correcting upon, you know, the previous generation's mistakes, right? But I will also say, like, they had inequities within their relationship, like her doing most of the cooking. Mm-hmm. However, my mom inherited money from her father, who had sent her away.
Wow.
That allowed her, that she then, like, maintained as her own within their marriage, that allowed her a degree of freedom around food and cooking, which is to say, we ate out a lot. Like she, and so it was like this very fraught literal inheritance for her of the father whose like love was very much like conditioned upon her being sent away, placing her baby for adoption, you know, being traumatized by the experience, then, you know, gave her money across the course of his life that allowed her some degree of freedom within her marriage that made it so that they didn't ever have to confront that particular kind of domestic inequity.
Yeah.
So
also, okay, so correct my timeline if I'm wrong here. So your mom got pregnant with you when she was 37?
Yeah, or 39, something yeah. around there, and, in 84.
And they had been together for at least a while. Like, they'd been married for, like, 7 years?
7 years.
And
7 years.
But together, I'm assuming, before that, for a bit. And, like, yeah. your mom had, like, lived some life. Like, she got, I mean, apart from everything that we've already been talking about, but, like, had lived her 20s, like, had, she got a master's degree. Like, she had lived her life, and your parents had a long relationship before you arrived.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, we see this now that I think oftentimes, like, so if you have time to kind of figure out who you are in relationship to one another and who you are as a person, it's oftentimes a little bit easier to negotiate parenthood and only having one kid in the family at that time, right?
Yes. Well, and also, like, I think about my mom was very clear that, like, before she met my dad, she was very clear she thought she was going to never get married. In her own words, she was like, I figured I would have affairs for the rest of my life, because she didn't see herself becoming a wife, because she couldn't imagine finding a man who would treat her as an equal.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's really interesting. She was like, I'm not going to do that. And then she found my dad, who she felt like was a man who was, you know, willing to treat her equally enough. Right.
Yeah. And as an intellectual equal.
Yes. Which I think that was number one for her. Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas my mom got married immediately out of graduating from college, which was very standard at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people got married in part because, like, there was still significant taboos in the 1970s about having, like, living with someone if you weren't married to them. Like,
yes.
Absolutely living in sin, like, really not okay. And your parents, like, still had this legislative control over your life even after you graduated from college.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of my mom's future was directed in other ways because she got married that young.
Yes.
And also had babies pretty young.
Yeah.
And, like, it was the right decision for her in so many ways. Mm-hmm. But also, like, my parents shouldn't have gotten married. Like, they got divorced when I was 15, in part because they, like, that's the person, like, if I got married to the person I was dating when I graduated from college, oh my God.
Oh my gosh. I feel like so many of my friends, we've, like, had that sort of mental exercise of, like, can you imagine?
Right. And, like, the person I was then and the person I've become. And so I think about that with this question that, like,
yeah,
it's really hard when you, obviously there are so many people who get married that young and figure it out. But also, if you go straight from your mother's care to your wife's care.
Yeah.
What skills as a man are you developing, I guess would say.
Yeah, it's such a good point. Yeah. And I think, too, about how this sense of a generational divide between a daughter looking at her mother, like, because I think, you know, like, my mom had this reaction to her mom's unhappy married existence in terms of who she chose as a partner, right? And then I had a reaction to my parents' relationship and who I chose as a partner. And I think, like, these reactions, too, can create this, like, real divide that is, I mean, I think a really positive thing in the sense that it is, in the best cases, like, a case of kind of we are evolving, we are moving forward, we're, you know, kind of escaping some of the traps of the past. But then it can be kind of hard to, like, meet each other and understand each other across that divide.
Yes. And I think about this all the time. I've talked to my mom about this, like, and I've written about it a lot, like, how so many of my larger choices are in some ways reactive to, like, I'm not going to have the life that my mom had. I'm going to try to figure out more active choices, like, whether that's, like I'm not married. I could totally be married, but, like, I'm not married, I think, in part because I want to, like, keep choosing that choice, or, like, always having a life raft so that I'm not in situations where, like, you have to stay in a marriage or anything like that.
Right.
Yeah. But sometimes that, like, becomes just this, like, fetishized independence as well.
Well, I know. And it's hard because it's like we can also become so trapped in our reaction to our moms.
Totally,
like, that's the other thing.
Totally.
That's like when I think about you know, again, like with the like me writing about sex, it's like there's both the like very positive here, like where it's like, you know, my mom was sent away in shame and it was all just like her experience was shrouded in secrecy. Right. And then I kind of did the opposite. Like, here's a personal essay about sex that I'm going to put on the internet. And I think that's like a positive sort of like, you know, movement away from shame. But also you get trapped in these things where you're trying to like prove yourself against your mom's past, her unhappiness, yeah. her pain, that is not always the best way to kind of move through and process that pain.
Yes, agreed. Okay, our next question comes from Lisa, and we got so many variations on this one. Melody's going to read it for us.
Are boomer moms more critical? My mom is the kind of mom who once greeted me by telling me my roots were showing. My mother says she's critical because she wants what's best for me and others to think well of me, that it's a form of love. Is this a mother-daughter thing? Did generations play into it? Immigration and proving ourselves in this place?
Okay, so what do we think? Is this boomer specific or is this mom specific?
I don't know, that's a tough one. Like, I mean, I'm like instantly hearing this, like I'm flashing to this memory of my mom who was not like very typically feminine in her self-presentation.
Yeah.
She liked to be comfortable. It was all about
my
like,
mom too.
Like it was yes, which I love. I like love that for her. It was like she always wore these like stretchy black pants, like this, like basically the same ones every day. And then like, you know, comfortable, flexible, flat-soled shoes. And I remember her putting her makeup on because she had a graphic design business that she started in San Francisco and she's putting her makeup on and she's like, I don't like doing this, but I have to do it to look professional. And so I just think about this generation of women in the workplace and what they tied, how they tied their appearance and self-presentation to legitimacy, like the ability to excel,
yeah.
to strive. But also how appearance was like, you know, it's like, this is how you get a husband also, like growing up with those kinds of messages. So
yes.
both like the, like in the romantic marital sphere, but also in the career world, like how important that like appearance was part of what we were talking about before, this kind of personal savvy
yeah.
of navigating this world and excelling within patriarchy. Like
yeah.
it's, you don't want your roots to show.
My mom's mom was incredibly critical. Like she also had tremendous amounts of anxiety. To the point that like at various points in her life, and again, these are things that my mom would tell me all the time as like part of our family lore, is like she had so much anxiety that she couldn't learn to drive. She Aww. Would like just like I think her life would be very different now with the medications that we have now, but maybe not yeah. because she might have been too ashamed to seek them. But like lived in suburban St. Paul and didn't drive, was absolutely terrified, and it got worse as she got older of like being around other moms and how they would think about her. Just like so much going on that I think my mom reacted to that very strongly as, I'm not going to be critical of you. Like, I really want you to be like playful and like figure out what you like to do with your appearance and all these things. And also like your mom loves to be comfortable.
Yeah.
And has her own sense of style, but like it doesn't align with like the professional norms. And when I was a kid, all I wanted was for her to be critical in that way. All I wanted was for her to like be like, let's go get you a better bra, or like, you know what I mean? Like just to care. Oh, I wanted her to yeah. care about all of the things that my friends' moms cared for.
Right. That is really interesting. I mean, I had a similar experience of like growing up with a mom who didn't care and then comparing her to the moms of my friends who really did care.
Yeah.
And I just like have like as it lives in my brain, it was like all my friends' moms were the kinds of moms who had like VHS workout tapes and uh-huh. like in the living room, and they had like the little, you know, like workout gear and all that stuff, and my mom was so adamantly against that, which now I'm like, oh, I feel like so lucky and grateful in many ways to have grown up with my mom, given that. But I remember at that time feeling like, oh, like my mom is not like other moms.
Yes, and, same.
You know, there was some like adolescent embarrassment around yes. That she didn't care and that she wouldn't wear makeup unless she really had to for professional reasons.
There was an after school meeting, and people who read the Hairpin, I wrote a piece about this at one point, but there was an after school meeting for cheerleading that I wrote a letter to my mom about exactly which dress she should wear, one of her teaching dresses, and was like, don't wear a sports bra, because she wore a sports bra.
Oh my God.
And then at the end of like, if you could please just do these things, love your daughter, Annie Peterson. And the full name just always gets to me. But I think that like I was trying to like, I was trying to get her to access these ideological norms and to like,
yeah,
like to put them on herself and to put them on me, because I was already working so hard to put them on me, you know?
I think that's such a good point too, because I think that is part of the criticism comes not just from moms wanting to protect their daughters from yes. the sort of consequences of appearing
yes.
not right, but also that they feel their daughters reflect upon them. 100%. And I think that's like this, like it's both at once. It's like they're wanting to protect you.
Yes.
And like themselves.
Yes. And I think like sometimes moms have done more work to excavate themselves from this larger stew and like maybe have figured out their own sense of style and like what feels important to them. And sometimes they haven't. Sometimes like, yeah. And that doesn't mean they're a worse person. It means yeah. that like maybe the constrictions were stronger where they grew up. Maybe there wasn't any other options. Maybe they saw like very vivid evidence of what happened and how people talked about people who didn't meet these ideas.
Right.
And you internalize that shit. Like you can try to unlearn it, but it's just there. It's just this well of judgment.
Right. Right. Well, that's the thing is I think it's like there are some like critical periods in our life where we really absorb these kinds of things.
Yes.
And it is remarkable, but it is also true that like for a woman in her 70s, like that it's really hard to escape that socialization that she got when she was in middle school. Like all the intervening decades, like, you know, yeah, maybe there's probably been some growth in that period around this stuff, but it's always going to kind of haunt you, I think.
Yeah. And I even think about that phrase, like, you look nice. And like, I think yeah. oftentimes what moms are looking for is for their daughters to look nice.
Yeah.
And what does that actually mean, right? It means yeah. like, it looks like you are a person who fits in. It looks like you are a person who is nice.
Well, and there's like an implied just like compliance.
Yes.
There.
Right.
Right. Too, which feels so important.
Yeah.
And I think that is part of, I think it's part of what all of this is like signaling compliance, like a willingness to conform. Yeah.
And I, you know, we didn't get any specific questions about this. Maybe one that I like. The difficulty sometimes, I think, in dealing with some gender unruliness, too, like
yes.
experimenting with different ways of self-presentation, like I think that can be hard because that was absolutely not allowed for our moms. Like my mom had to wear a right. dress or a skirt to school until she entered middle school.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's still so difficult for them to like understand that this is okay, and that you're still going to get jobs. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. But that is kind of like, I think what the stakes feel like for
yes.
many of these women is that it's like, you won't have a job. You'll be unhirable.
Or you won't find love. You won't,
love too.
You know,
like, that you won't have security in this world.
And that those yeah. things, and this gets to our larger point, that those things matter. Safety matters more than happiness.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's a really kind of traumatized perspective. Like, that's like, that is the perspective of someone who's in survival mode.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Who's kind of learned that and taken that on
yeah.
and never been able to let go. Yeah.
The Culture Study podcast is sponsored by Ollie. So I have kind of a gross story. Are you ready for it?
Oh, boy.
There are a lot of deer in our area, and they like to poop in our yard. Mm-hmm. And the other day, Steve had a little bit of a deer poop buffet on an empty stomach.
Oh, gosh.
And then it just really upset his tummy. He threw it all up and he wouldn't eat. He went on hunger strike because he has a really sensitive stomach. He wouldn't eat for like 2 days. And sometimes you just need to get him back into eating again. Mm-hmm. Like he just needs to get inspired. And so we brought out the big guns. We brought out the Ollie. Mm-hmm. Because Ollie is the best for dogs that are picky eaters, older dogs who don't have as much of an appetite, dogs like Steve that have sensitive stomachs that need to be like incentivized to eat. It's perfect in those occasions. And also, if your dog is just a normal dog like Bev who wants to eat everything all the time, obviously they also love Ollie. Ollie's fresh recipes are developed by real chefs and backed by vet nutritionists. They're obsessed with making the best meals with the highest quality ingredients. From the moment you start your subscription, everything is tailored to your pup. The meals are perfectly portioned and you get a little pup-tainer so that you can use this little scoop and put in like whatever portion that you didn't use, put it in the fridge. It's not gross like a can. It's the best. Get ready for both you and your dog to be obsessed. Head to ollie.com/culture. Tell them all about your dog and use code culture to get 70% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today. Plus, they offer an obsession guarantee. If you're not completely obsessed, you'll get your money back. That's ollie.com/culture and enter code culture to get 70% off your first box. Ollie, feed the obsession. Today's episode is sponsored by the Wild Alaskan Company. In the summertime, I want no hassle meals. And I want, if at all possible, to have as much of it made outside as possible. We don't have air conditioning because most houses here do not have air conditioning. But sometimes when we have a heat advisory, like we do now, because it's going to get to 75, you just have to figure out how to use the, like, what can I make that uses the grill that doesn't turn on the stove in any capacity? My perfect meal for this is what we call a dirty Caesar salad, and you can put chicken on it, but my favorite right now is to put salmon on it. And what I love is that the portions of salmon, I love the sockeye salmon from Wild Alaskan Company, two portions is the perfect amount to put on top of your Caesar salad. So we take some bread that we've frozen, put some olive oil on them, put them on the grill, then usually put on the salmon and then put on some asparagus if we have that on hand, maybe some zucchini, chop up some tomatoes from the garden, a little bit of Parmesan, not expensive Caesar salad, definitely not from scratch. It's also easy because you can keep a lot of the salmon stocked all year round. Each Wild Alaskan box comes with individually portioned fillets that are vacuum sealed, super easy to prep, and great for any meal, no matter how quick or elevated. All of the fish is quick frozen, fresh from Alaskan waters, which helps lock in its freshness, texture, flavor, and key nutrients like omega-3s. It's also fish you can trust with no GMOs, antibiotics, or other additives. And every order supports sustainable harvesting practices and Alaskan fishermen whose history is tied to the region and practice. Wild Alaskan Company is so confident that their fish is the best that they offer 100% satisfaction and money-back guarantee. So you can try your first box risk-free. Go to wildalaskan.com/culture for $35 off your first order of premium wild-caught seafood. Please reproduce my recipe and tell me how you like it. That's wildalaskan.com/culture for $35 off your first order. Thanks to Wild Alaskan Company for sponsoring this episode. Okay, this next question comes from Jackie. We got, I'm not kidding you, I think like 25 versions of this one. So it is clearly a thing that people are still dealing with. Here we go.
Why are boomer moms often so progressive and willing to learn and grow about so many things, but still unable to let go of diet culture? My mom was a lifelong progressive and feminist, despite living in a small town and having a somewhat conservative family, but she never stopped wanting to be skinny. What's up with that?
So I have to plug Virginia Solsmith's piece from a few years ago called The Grandparents Are Not Okay. This is actually, like, I did an interview with her even before that piece about
what I was noticing about a certain generation and the way that they talked about food. And she's just super smart on like the lessons that this generation had to internalize.
Yeah.
But what do you think? What are your thoughts here?
Oh, man. I mean, so many things. Like, I mean, okay, my first memoir was titled Want Me.
Yeah.
And it was a sexual coming of age memoir that was in part about me channeling my wants into being wanted by men.
Yeah.
And so maybe I'm a little biased here, but I think that this want to be wanted runs so deep in women's socialization across generations. Mm-hmm. And that desirability is deeply tied to like measurable real world rewards and punishments.
Yes.
And fat phobia is fundamental to ideas about desirability.
Yes.
In our culture.
Yes.
Right. So it makes sense. I mean, and that's across generations. I also think across generations, it's true that, you know, we can hold certain political beliefs that might be in tension with our own private sort of struggles and insecurities.
Yeah.
And we might feel bad about having those insecurities, given the way that they might seem to contradict with our politics. Mm-hmm. But I guess for boomer moms especially, I wonder about the pop culture that they grew up with.
Oh, my God.
You know, like, I guess I'm just thinking about Weight Watchers and, I don't know, the diet soda boom and, like, Slim Fast and all of that stuff. Like, I mean, that was also, like, I feel like that was also in the mix for me growing up. But I think it was directed very much at my mom's generation.
Yes, absolutely. And there weren't, like, positive representations of people being fat and happy, right?
No.
Like, this is, again, a way that, like, people were othered and made abject. And, like, you internalize that, like, if you are that sort of person, this is how people are going to talk about you. And I think we see this. I've just heard this from a lot of people talk, like, their boomer moms. The way that they gossip is about, like, this person got fat. And this is a way of regimenting control and like normalizing this over and over again. Like, when people get fat, we talk shit about them.
Yeah.
And it's so harmful for so many kids, but it also, like, this is a programmed thing of, like, how you police yourself is you have
yes.
to, like, show that it this is how people will talk about you.
Yeah. Well, and that feels so related to what we were talking about with the like, makeup stuff and self-presentation
yep.
stuff and it, like, being a way to signal compliance.
Yes.
Like, thinness or, you know, feeling bad about food is, like, a way of signaling compliance, mm-hmm. right? Like,
I'm so bad. Like, I'm eating this thing.
Ooh, I shouldn't. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The other thing I'll note, and this is just trying to, like, really, really be empathetic, is, like, a lot of moms of this generation did not get to exercise control in their professional lives, like, did not get to pursue the things in the public sphere that they might have wanted. And so what you do get to control is the private sphere. And that can be the ways that you raise your kids. It can be your house, like, being very fastidious about cleaning is another thing that I see a lot of. But then also you exercise that, like, that control on your own body.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Right. You exercise power where you can.
Yeah.
I'm, like, immediately just in hearing you say that, I'm thinking about how in the book, like, there's this moment where I am, like, confronted with all the, like, various teacups and little serving dishes that my grandmother collected.
Mm-hmm.
And this family member remarked, like, that she, you know, she was going to have to entertain my grandfather's, you know, business, you know, associates. She was going to have, like, the nicest dishware set possible. And it was like this family member remarked, like, she exercise power where she could.
Yeah.
And so it's like that idea of, like, exercising it on the body, exercising it within the home and the domestic sphere. Yeah.
I wanted to end the episode on a slightly lighter tone. And I love this question so much. It comes from Katie.
What is up with boomer mom food culture? And how did millennial food culture get so different? I think I'm mostly talking about white American boomers and millennials, but I'm open to being challenged on that. Why does my mom want a recipe for roasted asparagus? Why must everything be steamed? What is the purpose of egg beaters? When I'm home, I'm constantly surprised at how little I cook like my mom and how little she cooks like me. Is there always cooking generational divides? Or are millennials rebelling against 90s food norms for a specific reason?
So I have a twisted reaction to this one, which is that my mom doesn't cook like I think a lot of other boomers. That is in large part because she was constantly reacting to her mom's horrible Midwestern cooking. She was like, casseroles are banned in our house. She said that.
Oh, funny. Oh, my gosh.
And now I'm like, I love a casserole. But she would constantly tell us about, like, in her house, you would steam, like, growing up, her mom would steam the broccoli until it was, like, you could push your finger in, yeah, right? And it would just, like, turn to mush. And, like, the way that they would season it would just, like, melt some, like, a block of Velveeta. So some of my food tastes are, like, I loved going to grandma's house and having, like, a block of Velveeta on something. But...
Oh, totally.
But I... Yeah. So my mom tried to, like... be as like as gourmet mom as she could in Lewiston, Idaho. Like, you couldn't get basil, but she could still cook something from the back of Bon Appetit. You know what I mean?
Right. My mom was very similar. I mean, my mom, I grew up with like Midwestern comfort food was like what she did.
Yeah. What was her recipes?
She'd do things like fried chicken, potato gratin. There was like a corn potato souffle. Gratin. Oh, yeah. She had like a
that's
a
like
corn
what
souffle.
I wanted.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. I mean, I here's the thing. I grew up, I mean, this is so funny because I grew up in Berkeley, right?
Yeah.
But I like, it was not like an organic food kind of household.
Yeah.
It was like frozen dinners in the fridge, and then like the Midwestern comfort food.
All I wanted was a frozen dinner.
It was pretty great. Like, that frozen turkey tetrazzini was actually very good.
Totally bomb. No, and I should. My mom like absolutely loved to take us to Taco Time, and like we would like eat Tony's Pizza all the time. So I'm not trying to like make our house sound more gourmet than it is. But I do. The reason I wanted to do this question is because I think like the way that we learn to cook in our 20s, like it sticks with us no matter what.
Yeah.
So like I think the kids of millennial parents are going to be like, like, why do you put avocado in everything?
Why?
Like, why do you love this air fryer so much?
Yeah.
Like,
oh my God.
They're going to like stop making air fryers, and people are still going to have their air fryers from like 30 years ago and just be like popping everything in there. You know, like there are things that stick with us. Yeah.
I think that's very true. And I mean, that's certainly true for me in the sense that I like never really properly learned how to cook in my 20s, and that has stayed with me. So
my mom taught me a lot of things. I really appreciated that. Like, she just taught me some basics. And then like when I was a nanny, I was so bored that I would just plan meals that I would go home and make my roommates at night. So that was instrumental for me as well.
I would have loved you as a roommate. Oh my gosh.
I'd be like, oh, here's this thing that I found at the back of
incredible
gourmet or whatever.
Oh my God.
Okay. So can you stick around for our Ask Anything question? It's a good one.
Yes.
Okay, listeners, if you want our advice on boomer moms and gift giving, this is going to be a good one. Become a paid subscriber at patreon.com/culturestudy. Tracy, where can people find you if they want to hear more from you?
You can find me at tracyclarkflory.com. That has all my links. But you can also, if you want to listen to my podcast, you can find that at direstraitspod.com. That's straits with a G-H.
It's so good. Oh, my gosh.
It's a feminist critique of hetero love, sex, politics, and culture. My co-host is Amanda Monti, a wonderful author and writer. And find me on Instagram at Tracy Clark Flory. But also, please go buy my book.
Yes. Yes, please. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks for listening to the Culture Study Podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts because we have so many great episodes in the works, and I promise you don't want to miss any of them. If you want to suggest a topic, ask a question about the culture that surrounds you, or submit a question for our subscriber-only advice time segment, go to our Google form at tinyurl.com/culturestudypod or check the show notes for a link. And if you want to support the show and get bonus content, head to patreon.com/culturestudy. It's $5 a month or $50 a year, and you'll get ad-free episodes, an exclusive advice time segment, and weekly discussion threads for each episode. The Culture Study Podcast is produced by me, Anne Helen Peterson, and Melody Rowell. Our music is by Poddington Bear. You can find me on Instagram at Anne Helen Peterson, Melody at Melodious47, and the show at Culture Study Pod.